make a start. I'm very pleased indeed to welcome Sugi Tutos, who's a senior lecturer in Hindu studies at the University of Birmingham. She's got interest in Hinduism and feminism and contemporary modern Hinduism, and she's published a very good, very interesting book on Hinduism Imagined,
a post-colonial perspective,
yes. And your current work, something you're going to share with us today, is on 19th century Hindu discourse on image worship.
Yes.
So I'm very much looking forward to hearing what you have to say. So welcome to us each, yes.
Yeah, thank you so much. It'll be a bit informal. This is a long paper, so therefore I will be taking certain bits from this paper. The main aim of this paper is to offer a counter-narrative to 19th century discourse on image worship. You will find that most 19th century writings on Hinduism, to a great extent, focus on Ram Mohan Roy and Dayananda Saraswati. And these two thinkers were against image worship, and they are seen as sort of two significant examples of what academics or people tend to call modern Hinduism. And in the 19th century, there were other significant religious thinkers or saints who were for image worship, and they were perhaps not given the kind of prominence that Ram Mohan Roy and Dayananda Saraswati were given. And especially in 19th century India, you find in Bengal, where Ram Mohan Roy was born, you have the example of Ramakrishna Paramahamsa, who was an ardent devotee of Kali and also a temple priest. And you also find a good example in the Swaminarayan movement in Gujarat in 19th century India. So there were, and of course you have other significant movements as well, but I'm just naming a couple of them here. So the iconic worship was seen as detrimental by Ram Mohan Roy and Dayananda Saraswati, whereas these two movements, Swami Narayan and Ramakrishna, they were trying to demonstrate iconic worship need not be detrimental to social progress or moral progress. What I want to do here in this paper is to bring a different personality from Sri Lanka. His name is Arumuga Navalar, again a 19th century Hindu Shaivite. And he offers a counter-narrative to Roy and Dayananda Saraswati. So main focus is in this paper is to show how Navalar, Arumuga Navalar, a Shaivite, offers a counter-narrative to anti-Hindu, anti-image worship, so to speak. So basically what I'm saying here is 19th century colonial India offers examples of both Hindu iconoclasts and iconic worshippers, but there has been a tendency to privilege the former and regard them as agents of modernity and the latter as backward. And here all the three Hindu reformers whom I mentioned belong to 19th century colonial period. Roy, a Vaishnavite Brahmin from Bengal, Dayananda, a Shaivite Brahmin from Gujarat, and Arumuga Navalar, a Shaivite Velala from Jaffna in Sri Lanka. Although they came from varied backgrounds and were influenced by different sources, they were reacting to the 19th century Protestant missionary attack on Hindu religious beliefs and practices and were redefining Hinduism. While Roy and Dayananda took a missionary attitude to image worship, Navalar defended iconic worship with a missionary zeal. Of the three, Roy and Navalar were more acquainted with Western Protestant Christianity and were involved in Bible translation. Roy and Navla's relationship with the Christian missionaries was initially genial, although later both were engaged in fierce theological controversy with the missionaries. Dayananda is known for his polemical debate with Christian missionaries and for his proclamation of the primacy of Vedic revelation. I think most of you are familiar with Roy and Dayananda Saraswati, am I correct? Okay, so therefore I shan't go more into the details of Roy and Dayananda Saraswati, but just go on straight on to the comparing, juxtaposing this. Maybe I'll say a little bit about Arumuga Navalar, because Arumuga Navalar, a Sri Lankan Tamil, was born in Nallur in Jaffna at a time, that is in 1882, at a time when Protestants from England and America had already established themselves in Jaffna and were engaged in a missionary campaign to win Shaivas and Muslims to Christianity. Shaivism is a major religious force among Tamil-speaking Hindus. Navalar not only learned Tamil from his father, a Tamil scholar, but also became proficient in the language and was conferred the title Navalar, meaning the learned. He was also well-versed in Sanskrit. Unlike Roy, Navalar studied English at an early age. As with many Hindus of his time, he was educated in an English Methodist, Christian Methodist school in Jaffna. At the very young age of 19, Navalar was not only teaching Tamil and English in the school where he studied, but was also assisting Peter Percival, principal of Wesleyan Seminary in Jaffna, with the translation of the Bible into Tamil, thereby acquiring a comprehensive knowledge of the Hebrew scriptures. Unlike Roy and Dayananda, who were objecting to image worship, Navalar was challenging the Christian missionary critique of Shaiva worship practices by drawing attention to similar practices in the biblical religion. So here, what I want to do is now, under three or four headings I want to discuss. All the three of them use scriptures to affirm image worship or to denounce image worship. And I'll start with the scriptural warrant first and then go on to the other things, okay? Like 19th century European Orientalists and missionaries, Roy, Dayananda and Navalar took upon themselves the task of enlightening their fellow Hindus about the true nature of Hinduism. All three use scriptural sources to make a case for their respective points of view with regard to image worship. Whilst Roy and Dayananda argue that true worship is free of idolatrous, practices, Navalar maintains that true worship cannot be divorced from iconic worship. Roy and Dayananda take the non-iconic form of worship of the Supreme Being as the universal norm, and any deviation of it from it is seen as unacceptable, so to speak. Okay. Roy, as most of you know, affirms the primacy of the Upanishads and the Vedanta and accepts the validity of Smriti texts such as the Puranas and the Tantras insofar as they concur with this monotheistic conception of God. And so therefore, compared to Dayananda Saraswati, Roy is perhaps more willing to accept to some extent image worship as being inferior, but it has to be discarded, so to speak. And as most of you know, Dayananda Saraswati totally depended on the Vedas to affirm Hindu worship, going back to the Vedas in order to affirm the purity of worship. And he discarded even the Puranas and all of the scriptures were seen as anti-Vedic. There are quotations here which I don't want to read. They were all seen as anti-Vedic teaching and they are false. So here you have in Dayananda Saraswati a kind of a binary approach, and even in Roy a binary approach, but there is a kind of an ambivalence in Roy's approach to image worship. Okay. And for Dayananda Saraswati, idol worship is, he says, a quite interesting quotation I like. Idol worship cannot be compared with a staircase. It may be more appropriately be looked upon as a deep ditch. Whoever falls into it is hacked into pieces, can never come out of it, and even dies there. such is the vehement attack on image worship. Okay, now coming to Navala, while Roy and Dayananda argue that image worship is not sanctioned in the Vedas, Navala not only draws on Saiva Agamas, the primary source of authority for iconic worship of Shiva, but also uses Hebrew texts to challenge the missionary critique of Saiva practices. Saivas see the Agamas as Shruti, as having come from the very tongue of Shiva himself. Unlike the Vedas, which were accessible only to a minority, the Agamas were open to all, regardless of caste or gender, the grace of Shiva being freely available to all who sought him and worshipped him with devotion. The Agamas do not reject the authority of the Veda, but modify it, thus making it more all-inclusive and accessible to everyone through purifying initiation called Diksha. For Shaivas, the Agamas are supreme and in some respects more authoritative than the Veda, as they do not permit animal sacrifice. Saiva Agamas deal with both philosophical and ritual aspects of Shaiva worship of the deity. If Roy and Dayananda Saraswati were reminding Hindus of the purity of the ancient Veda, Navala was reminding Shaivas of the purity of the Agamas. But perhaps Roy and Dayananda Saraswati may not accept the Agamas, but that's a different matter here. Now, the next point which I want to discuss here is, I've just spoken a little bit of the scriptural warrant, how to some extent we find here a kind of a Protestant preoccupation with the text. This is not to say that Hinduism does not have examples of an iconic worship. We have a long tradition of metaphysical and iconism, but it looks as though they were using the methodology of the Protestant missionaries in order to, as a kind of counter narrative to affirm Hinduism. It's almost like they're using Western tools to affirm Hinduism, to speak back. The empire strikes back, sort of here, in one sense. So now the next point, what I want to talk about here is text and tradition. What role text and tradition play in this discourse on image worship? And the debate on Murti Puja raises the question of the relation between text and tradition, or parampara. And Vasudhar Dalmia has discussed at great length the relation between text and parampara, and the hermeneutical issues generated by the 1869 debate on Murti Puja between Dayananda and Harichandra, an eminent educationist and patron of arts, who defended Murti Puja on the basis of tradition. The crux of the debate was that since Murti Puja was not sanctioned in the Veda, it needed to be discarded. For Roy, Dayananda and Navala, the written text has greater validity than established custom or tradition. Whilst Roy and Dayananda use the Vedas to oppose image worship and reject the established tradition, Navala invokes Shaiva scriptures, the Agamas, for the contrary reason, that is to affirm the iconic worship of Shiva, as well as to challenge any departure from the Agamic traditions and norms with regard to worship. Roy and Dayananda's contention is that because image worship has been practiced from time immemorial, it does not mean that it is an authentic form of worship. Both Roy and Dayananda argue that it does not make any sense to find a basis for Murti Puja in tradition, for it's constantly changing and therefore unreliable. You cannot depend on it. But as with Roy and Dayananda, Navala's thought scriptural warrant, but for the opposite reason, namely to justify Murti Puja. He was not only affirming temple worship, but was also keen that Agamic rules were followed in the construction of the temple. If Roy and Dayananda were keen to recover the purity of Vedic worship or non-image worship, Navala was keen to recover the purity of Agamic worship. Navala took to task the temple trustees of the Kandasamy temple in Nallur in Jaffna for not adhering to the Agamic rules. His critique was the temple was constructed according to the Agamic conventions. So again, raising again here, he was more a textual purist, where everything has to have textual kind of verification, so to speak. And for all the three reformers, textual tradition was very important. Parampara begins and ends with text. and custom or tradition has little validity. So the point here is the tradition is to be located in or within text. So there's no tradition outside the text. So anything outside the text is not taken seriously. So everything has to conform to text in such a rigid manner. So in other words, text is to be located in or within text. Roy and Dayananda define tradition narrowly, despite the tradition encompassing various modes, strands within it. They view the tradition in terms of Shruti texts, the Vedas and the Upanishads, which are seen as authentic or containing purified Hinduism. As for Navala, tradition includes both the Vedas and the Saiva Agamas, and any deviation from the Agamic textual instructions in matters of worship is unacceptable. What is clear is that for Roy, Dayananda, Navala, adherence to the authority of scripture is absolutely vital, and any deviation from it is seen as sacrilege. While selective appropriation of text is not unusual within the Indian tradition, what is rather extraordinary is that the singular emphasis on textual tradition as the ultimate norm to assess the validity of custom and practice. That is the point I'm just making here. So then again, to cut my essay short here, Roy and Daya look at worship in terms of rational and irrational, pure and impure, and more in binary terms, although you do find, as I pointed out, some ambivalence in Roy's understanding of image worship. And they use buddhi or reason as a hermeneutical tool to demonstrate that image worship is not true worship, or rather it's false worship. Therefore, worship of images is false worship. Again, a kind of a missionary attitude to image worship here. So whilst Roy and Dayananda regard image worship as irrational and a departure from true worship, Navala considers the worship of Shiva as Shiva rational and as constituting true worship. For Navala, it is scripture and the divine revelation that establish the validity of image worship. Navala regards Shiva himself sanctioning image worship and offering directions as how to perform Saiva worship. Since Shiva himself is seen as a compassionate Lord, Shaivas are relating not to a material image, but to Shiva himself, who makes himself accessible to his devotees in various places. I don't want to read all the quotations there. I'll skip all that. Whilst Roy and Daya engage in divesting Hinduism of all its ritual practices, Navala is vigorously demonstrating that Saiva ritualistic tradition is a noble one and that Shaiva bhakti purifies the devotee. It is bhakti or devotion that sanctifies both worship and the worshipper. And this would apply to all monotheistic bhakti movements within the Hindu tradition. As Vasudha Dalmia has rightly pointed out, bhakti is one of the most strongest arguments in defense of Hindu worship. It takes several forms and allows for several ways of relating to the divine, but is directed towards a specific goal. Roy and Dayananda's ethical monotheism has little room for bhakti. The contention is that image worship cannot possibly inculcate pure devotion. They do not seem to take note of the sanctifying aspect of devotion, which regulates moral conduct and behavior of the devotees. So now I want straight to plunge on to the differences between all the three of them here. What is very interesting is, unlike Roy and Dayananda Saraswati, Navala does not subscribe to the orientalist thesis of pure Hinduism and degenerate Hinduism. There is no record of that kind of thinking in Navala's writings, unless one wants to interpret it differently. One of the striking points of departure between these two Indian reformers and Navala is that whilst Roy and Dayananda subscribe to the oriental thesis of original purity and decadence, which is of course resonance with the Hindu theory of yugas, Navala did not see Saivism as a degenerate religion. By contrast, he drew analogies between Saiva and biblical ritual practices in order to challenge the missionary critique of Saiva worship and demonstrate that there was nothing wrong with Saiva ritual practices. If Roy and Dayananda were trying to recover the lost purity of the Veda, Navala was keen to revive Saivism, but not in terms of a bygone golden past, which had little to do with rituals or ritual purity that Navala was trying to restore. He was nevertheless trying to revive agamic textual purity, streamline, this is the word nerupaduthal, that's the word that's used in Tamil. He was trying to streamline traditional practices in accordance with agamic conventions. He wanted to make Saivism intelligible and meaningful to Shaivas who had either forgotten or given up due to ignorance or under the influence of Christian persuasion. Roy and Dayananda saw ritual acts as futile exercises and as an obstacle to true worship, whereas Navala argued that Saiva rituals performed with devotion sanctified worship and purified the devotee of all vices. Navala set about purifying popular Saiva practices, and this required elimination of animal sacrifices and the worship of cruel deities. Saiva agamas did not permit animal sacrifice, and in this respect, the agamas were seen as being purer than the Vedas, which sanctioned animal sacrifice in the past. Okay. A true Shaivite, in Navala's view, would reject animal sacrifice. So Navala's revival of purified form of Saivism was mainly meant for the upper class Velalas or Satsudras, as Navala called them, and it alienated those who practiced animal sacrifice and participated in festivals and Terukutu, which means street dances. His attitude to Brahmins was ambivalent. On the one hand, Navala held them in high esteem in his writings, but on the other, he was at odds with them in matters of ritual and doctrine, as has been in his conflict with Brahmin priests, failure to conform to agamic conventions. Navala was essentializing Shaivite ritualistic tradition. It's very interesting where Roy was sort of demythologizing Hindu practices. Here, Navala was essentializing the Saiva ritualistic practices. That is the point, again, I'm trying to make here. The missionary critique was that Saivism lacked any sense of morality, and this was attributed to idolatry and temple worship. While Navala questioned such negative portrayal, Roy and Dayananda not only disapproved of Hindu worship and related practices, but also saw them as leading to all possible vices. And again, I'll skip those quotations. In fact, Dayananda lists quite a lot of evils in his Satya Prakash. He talks about idol worship leading to ignorance, indolence, poverty, adultery, theft, fraud, disunity, loss of moral sense, so forth and so on. Okay, so image worship is seen as corrupting one's moral sense, leading to illicit affairs, etc. Again, here both Dayananda Saraswati and Roy sound very missionary, kind of the missionary denunciation of Hindu practices is very clear in their writings. Navala, unlike Roy and Dayananda, did not associate image worship with moral decadence or see gods as promoting immorality. Although, like Roy, Navala called for an allegorical reading of some passages in the Puranas. This comes out clearly in his polemical defense of Murugan, the Hindu deity, who was seen by missionaries as not a good example of morality. So this is, again, there. A lot of missionaries, as you know, were criticizing Hindu deities such as Krishna, and even other gods as sort of as examples of immorality, like William Ward and many others. And then, of course, Roy and others tried to overcome that issue by saying that we will have to read them metaphorically, not literally, and that's a different matter. I won't go into it right now here. Whilst Dayananda held Brahmin priests responsible for the degeneration of pure worship enshrined in the Veda, even Roy blamed the Brahmin priests for the degeneration of pure form of worship, Navala took Brahmin priests to task for not adhering to scriptural agamic norms in their worship of Shiva. So while Dayananda and Roy were reviving textual Hinduism, a kind of elitist Hinduism, Navala was demonstrating there was nothing wrong with Shaiva ritualistic practices which had scriptural sanction. He was passionately engaged in protecting Saivism from missionary onslaught. This required the Shaivas were educated in the basics of their own faith so that they could effectively offer a counter-narrative. I think at times even Navala became very polemical, saying that Shiva has sent Christian missionaries to chastise Shaivas for not following their faith. He turned turn the story other way around. So because he was quite conversant with Hebrew texts, because he helped with the translation, he knew all the parallels between the Hebrew rituals and the Shaiva rituals. And he thought the missionaries of that particular time could not take a high moral ground to defend their tradition, but criticize Shaiva rituals. So that's what I'm going to just now concentrate, Shaiva and biblical rituals. Maybe then, there's quite a lot, but I'll have to stop somewhere, okay? Unlike Roy and Dayananda, who disregarded devotional Hinduism, Navala was trying to revive it. He was engaged not only in revitalizing Shaivism, but also demonstrating the hermeneutical fallacy of the missionary critique of devotional Hinduism. Being highly conversant with both Shaiva and Hebrew scriptures, Navala was able to challenge the missionary attack on Shaiva worship and ritual practices. Pointing out the similarities between Shaiva and biblical religious practices, he made missionaries see that it was not right on their part to take the high moral ground when it came to Hindu practices. He drew attention to the striking similarities between Shaiva temple rituals and those in the Jerusalem temple, as referred to in his book Shaiva Thusana Pariharam. Navala was able to, this big fat book I ordered from India. My husband helped me to read. Now, I can read Tamil, but my husband, he can read, he writes in Tamil also. So he helped me to read those bits quite carefully and asked him to translate it a little bit more carefully for me. Navala was able to show missionaries that what they detested in Shaivism was to be found in their own religion. He found it ironic that the missionaries should ridicule Shaiva temple worship, sacred sites, ritual bathing, observance of auspicious days and times, holy days when they were present in their own scriptures. This was tit for tat, okay? Given that the Hebrew text contained references to such practices, missionaries ought to have been more sensitive to such practices among Shaivas. Navala demonstrated that Shaiva ritual practices such as anointing Shiva Lingam, Naivedya, ritual food offering, arati, lighting of lamps, singing kirtans, and dancing, ritual bathing, absolution for sins, are not strange as appear. Such practices are clearly depicted in Hebrew scriptures. If Protestant missionaries found the Shaiva worship of Linga offensive, Navala found the Linga comparable to the Jewish Ark of the Covenant. For Shaivas, the Linga was not an obscene symbol, but an expression of Shiva's creative energy. As you know, the Linga came under severe attack from British Protestant missionaries. Navala contested the missionary critique of Shaivism as being polytheistic by pointing out that such a belief was to be found in their own Hebrew texts. His point was that missionaries could hardly accuse Shaivas of being polytheistic when they themselves worship three gods, Jehovah, Christ, and the Holy Spirit. I'm not saying, he's saying it, okay? In fact, Navala saw Shaivism as being more consistent than Christianity, in that it had no difficulty in reconciling the oneness of Shiva with these many manifestations. He did not deny that Shaivas worship other gods, but they were seen as the servants or slaves of the Supreme Lord. So here I end the Shaiva parallels. Then I've got quite a lot here. Again, I need to skip. So we have other 19th century narratives, like the Vaishnava narrative, the Swaminarayan movement in Gujarat, and we have the Ramakrishna mission in Bengal. And they affirmed iconic forms of worship. And as all of you know, they were involved in social work and in transforming society, so forth. And so I don't repeat that. But I have two sections here. One is to do, I don't know how much time we have. One is to do with tradition versus modernity. And what does reform mean both to Hindus and to Europeans? Or maybe I can stop here and can discuss. I can. What would you suggest?
You can carry on for a bit.
Carry on for a bit. Okay. Mm. So I'll go for that. Okay. There has been a tendency to view the 19th century debate on image worship in terms of a simple opposition between tradition and modernity, decadence and progress, resistance and reform. In other words, there's an implicit or explicit assumption that modernity signifies development and progress, and tradition the opposite. And to attribute the modernization of Hinduism to the 19th century British impact on Hinduism. I think one cannot totally deny that, but there are certain qualifications. That's what I want to address here. First, the concepts such as tradition, modernity are problematic. These terms are not helpful in understanding the complexity of the 19th century religious and social history. Both liberal and orthodox Hindus were not always at loggerheads with each other. Although they significantly differed in certain matters such as sati and image worship, they shared similar concern in other areas such as education of girls. Second, the tradition versus modernity debate takes a rather simplistic view of a complex scenario. It takes a linear view of history, which is known to everyone. It portrays Indian society as having been in a state of decadence until awakened by colonial modernity. Europeans and even some Hindus tended to compare 19th century Hindu Renaissance, what's called Hindu Renaissance, with the European Renaissance. Even Ram Mohan Roy himself compares. In other words, the Hindu Renaissance came to be seen predominantly as the birth of modernity in India, such as Europe had witnessed earlier in its history. Non-Western societies came to be perceived and assessed in terms of the Enlightenment notions of rationality, reform, and progress. Reform was associated with improvement, and this was seen largely in terms of 19th century colonial India, implying that previous periods were submerged in darkness. Although social and religious changes had taken place in the Bhakti period and at the time of the Buddha, Guru Nanak, and others, these changes were not taken into account. Whilst 19th century impact on Hinduism cannot be underestimated, it's important to note that the whole process was far more intricate. Modernity is complex in that it cannot be confined to a single point in history. Some Indian scholars do not see anything particularly unique about the 19th century Indian Renaissance, but consider it as, to quote, only one in a series of successive developments in Indian history, unquote, and do not necessarily link the revival with early significant figures such as Ram Mohan Roy, but with later 19th century saints such as Ramakrishna, who never had any formal or modern schooling. Vasudha Dalmia cautions against taking a linear view of modernity, problematizing the term modernization in her discussion of the 19th century Murti Puja. Dalmia argues that tradition is not static. I quote, there was a wide-based movement to re-establish tradition, for which the term modernization seems wholly appropriate. If modernization is to be understood as an operation which entails a process of alteration, an improvement of what is basically an older and already an institution or system in order to accord better with contemporary times, I unquote. Then there has been a tendency to attribute 19th century critique of image worship to Western influences. Yes, one cannot totally disagree with that. Again, there are certain qualifications. Both Ram Mohan Roy and Dayananda Saraswati's denunciation of image worship have resonance with the 19th century Protestant critique of image worship. But this does not imply that they were uncritical mimics, nor does it mean that an iconism was less Indian or Hindu. Roy and Dayananda's initial thoughts on image worship were formulated long before their exposure to the West. But the missionary critique of Hinduism no doubt aggravated their response to missionary critique, so to speak. In fact, both were disenchanted at an early age, as most of you know, with image worship. With Roy, he knew Arabic, and he produced a booklet on a gift to monotheists or something when he was at the age of 16. So there are some examples to show that before they encountered the West, both Roy and Dayananda Saraswati were disenchanted with image worship. In the case of Dayananda Saraswati, there's a famous story that his father wanted him to guard the Shiva temple, and he saw the mice running all around, and he was totally disenchanted. And there's this story of his guru asking him to proclaim the primacy of the Vedic revelation. And of course, coming into contact with missionaries also meant they were also using the Protestant tools, hermeneutical tools, in order to revive Vedic tradition or an iconic worship. So therefore, the methodology they borrowed, I would imagine, from the West, from Protestant missionaries. But there's a long history of metaphysical and iconism, as has been shown by many Western and Indian scholars writing on this particular subject. So I don't want to read all of that bit here. So therefore, to attribute everything to Western influence would be perhaps not acknowledging that there is a tradition of metaphysical and iconism within the Indic tradition, so to speak. And then Jordan's has shown that it's possible that Dayananda was quite aware of Jainism in Gujarat, and it's possible that he has borrowed certain elements from Jainism, and you know, so there is evidence to show that. But this is not to simply excuse the fact that they did not borrow from the Western Protestant tradition. They were nevertheless influenced by the Protestant hermeneutical kind of methodology. In that sense, they were using that as a tool, as a counter attack. That's what I think. Maybe that's open to discussion. Then again, some scholars would attribute Roy's critique to entirely Western influences, but various scholars like Halbas and Ray Chowdhury and even Dermot Killingly and many others, they want to point out to variety of influences in Roy's critique of image worship. His rationalism cannot be totally attributed to Western influence, although there's an element of that in his critique of it, because during his time, perhaps rationalism was not all that predominant in the West as it has been claimed to be. This is the contention that some people are making. Okay, so here, Roy did not privilege faith over reason, but true faith had to be consistent with reason. Roy rejected both Hindu and Christian miracles and incarnation because they could not stand the test of reason. He was looking for a norm that was universally valid. The ethical aspect was seen to have universal sort of resources, so to speak. Rationality functioned as the one critical tool by which Hinduism as well as other religions were assessed by Roy. As Ray Chowdhury points out, I quote, "The end produce was a universalist, non-denominational monotheism, intellectually accessible to the elites, which had resonance of an Upanishadic and medieval doctrine." Given the indigenous critique of image worship by Kabir, Nanak, Ramprasad, Roy's own exposure to Islamic education and his tufat, it's possible that all these factors, as well as encounter with Western thought, would have contributed to his rationalist stance, but cannot be solely confined to European thought. And then with Dayananda, I've just said, he's drawn from his guru and from the tradition. And then to skip this, and the last one, if I have time, or reform and revitalization.
Yes.
Okay. What did reform mean to Hindus and Europeans? Reform meant different things to different people. For 19th century European missionaries, reform meant ridding Hinduism of what they saw as pagan beliefs and practices, and paving the way for implicit or explicit Christianization of Hinduism, and this implied modernization of Hinduism. For Hindus, faced with a scathing missionary critique of Hinduism at that time, reform meant restoring Hinduism to what they perceived as its original purity, located in the Vedas, and resisting Christianization. It also meant demonstrating that Hinduism has resources within itself to purify its religious practices. Hinduism may have lost its purity, but it can reinvent itself and challenge negative criticism leveled at Hindu practices. Defending himself against the charge that he was posing as a reformer or a discoverer of pure Hinduism, Roy declared that his aim was to draw attention to the pure Hinduism contained in the Vedanta. Roy and Dayananda found in the Orientalist thesis of original purity and decadence a convenient tool to offset the negative missionary appraisal of Hinduism. Naveller, however, did not subscribe to the Orientalist thesis, which regarded iconic Hinduism as a sign of decadence. He saw his hermeneutical task as neripaduthal, a Tamil word which means regulating the practices and rituals of Shaivas. He was regulating Saiva practices, and this meant divesting Saivism of animal sacrifices or forbidding animal sacrifices. In a broader sense, reform meant educating Shaivas in the fundamentals of their own faith so that they would be able to deal effectively with the missionary critique of Shaiva worship. As Rajanayagam remarks, I quote, "Naveller did not create new Saivism or a new definition of it. This Bhakti and Shaiva Siddhanta had done, but reaffirmed the old tenets and the old order in toto. He did not create any schism, but cemented and streamlined what went before and what had been superseded by Christianity," I unquote. Although he borrowed and applied Christian missionary methods to Saivism, they were used for furthering the cause of Saiva Dharma rather than disrupting its sanctity. Just totally the opposite of Roy. In novelist thinking, Tamil and Saiva revival are closely connected. Besides Sanskrit, which is considered the sacred language of Hindus, Tamil is also seen as a sacred language by both Tamil Shaivites and Vaishnavites, you know, the Tamil Veda. For both, Tamil is the medium of divine revelation. Usually we see only Sanskrit as the medium of divine revelation, but Shaivas and Vaishnavites would want to claim that God has spoken to them in Tamil, and that's well known. And Navala felt that Shaivas need to learn Tamil, the Tamil language, in order to understand the Shaiva roots. And this knowledge was not only necessary for liberation, but also for preventing Christianity making inroads into Shaiva territory. See, if we don't know our language, then we are lost. Others can dominate us. There's no defense mechanism there. So Navala in his time was very keen the Shaivas would be educated in Tamil, and when they're educated in their language, then they would better understand Shaivism, and they will be able to offer a counter-narrative to missionary enterprise. And he also became very polemical towards the end, perhaps sometimes even bitter, I think. If Dayananda Saraswati made Sanskrit Veda accessible to both Hindus and Hindu men and women of diverse castes so that they would return to the purity of the tradition, Navala rendered classical Tamil sacred texts such as the Periyapuranam into prose, and thus making it accessible to ordinary Shaivas. Navala was a defender of not only Shaiva doctrine and ritual, but also of caste against missionary onslaught. He did not challenge caste, but made Shaivas aware of the caste dharma. The caste system in Sri Lanka is very different to the caste system in India. A lot of people are not aware of that. The Brahmins are not the high caste in Sri Lanka. The Brahmins serve as temple priests, and the Velalas, the landowning community, are seen as the high caste. The landowning community, they employ Brahmin priests to officiate in temples. So they have a lot of power. The Velalas have a lot of power. So it's all to do with power, isn't it? Whether one is a Brahmin or a non-Brahmin. Navala was a defender of not only of Shaiva doctrine, but ritual, but also of caste against missionary onslaught. He did not challenge caste, but made Shaivas aware of the caste dharma. In his thinking, Shaiva religious practice was closely linked to notions of purity and pollution, not in the oriental sense of the term. In Navala's case, reform meant bringing back these elements into Shaiva thinking. Therefore, reform meant reinterpreting the agamic precepts of purity and agamic agamic concepts of purity and pollution in a moral way. Navala was not so much reforming Shaivism as bringing it in line with the orthodox Shaiva beliefs and practices, and this required that Shaivism was purged of popular or folk elements as well as Christian influences. Therefore, there is some tension in Navala's reform activities. On the one hand, he wanted to revive and protect the orthodox form of Shaivism from missionary and other influences. And to do this, Navala turned to Tamil and Sanskrit Brahminical tradition, textual tradition, that is Tamil texts and the Veda, and accorded Brahmins an exalted position. Unlike in the Sanskrit tradition, where Vedas were not accessible to those of the other castes, Navala allowed this privilege to the Velalas, as well as the right to wear the sacred thread. But at the same time, he chastised Brahmins of Kadasami temple for not following the Shaiva doctrine and ritual prescriptions. So the Brahmin priests had to conform to the agamic norms, and he chastised them for not following. Basically, it is not following your tradition. So in his understanding of purifying it, it has perhaps some resonances. We can discuss that. Unlike Dayananda, Navala did not challenge caste practices, but was keen to maintain them. Okay, then I will skip a few things, okay? If Roy and Dayananda saw image worship as a source of all evils, and I'm coming to an end here, and were intent on stamping it out, Bhakti-oriented movements were keen on establishing the validity of image worship. As shown, the reformatory measures undertaken by the Swaminarayan movement challenged Roy and Dayananda's contention that image worship is detrimental to progress of humanity. And I'll skip a few things, okay? For that matter, Arya Samaj, which was against iconic worship, supported the construction of the Ayodhya temple. So it's quite ironic, okay? Iconic Hindu, I've just written that one here. So now coming to an end, So now iconic Hinduism in various forms is flourishing in diaspora here. And we are trying to restore temple Hinduism in diaspora. What was shunned by missionaries and what was shunned by Dhananda Saraswati and what was shunned by Ramhan Roy. What was seen as a decadent Hinduism and detrimental to spiritual, economic, and social progress has now become a successful enterprise rather than a liability. The question is not whether ideas are traditional or modern, pre-modern or post-modern, but rather the question is what can be gained from these ideas and distinctions. And here I think, although Amartya Sen is a secular kind of Hindu, I like his quotation here. Amartya Sen puts it very clearly. Modernity, I quote, modernity is not only a befuddling notion, it is also basically irrelevant as a pointer of merit or demerit in assessing contemporary priorities. All three, Roy, Dhananda, and Navala, were intent on revitalizing Hinduism in their own respective ways. They were not interested in proselytization. While Dhananda was key to draw back Hindu converts back to the Hindu fold through the rite of purification, Shuddhi, and unfortunately that's happening today in India, Navala was keen for Shaivas to become true Shaivas. While he felt sympathy for those who left their faith, he saw it his duty to educate Shaivas in their own tradition and to proclaim Shaivism to his fellow Hindus. Navala was a vigorous campaigner for Shaivism and even used missionary methods and modern tools such as printing press to propagate Shaivism to Shaivas. He not only recruited Shaiva preachers to preach Shaivism at temple locations, he also established Shaiva school system. Dhananda started Vedic schools for men and women. Roy was in favor of imparting English education to Indians. Although he was interested in Sanskrit, he favored English education at one point. Ramhan Roy and Dhananda's representation of Hinduism exclusively in iconic terms is not in keeping with the heterogeneity of a tradition which is both iconic and aniconic. They narrowly represent the tradition that is evidenced in their selection of texts and the projection of a single Godhead that allows for no diversity in belief and practice. A tradition that's predominantly rich in iconography and iconic forms of worship is reduced to a dry aniconism. To put it differently, both these thinkers offer a sanitized Hinduism, divested of all its varied remarkable features. They isolate a particular strand within a complex and diversified tradition and project their version as representing the true nature of Hinduism. They grant it a higher and unique status and in effect essentialize and universalize it. These thinkers are selective in the textual appropriation and offer a Hinduism that is downsized, flattened and uniform in belief and practice. In other words, they proclaim a monotheism that is dismissive of plurality. While selective appropriation of texts is not something alien to the Hindu tradition, where Ramhan Roy and Dhananda stand out is in their relentless and persistent emphasis on uncompromising monotheism as the true nature of Hinduism. This paper also problematizes Ramohan's and Dayananda's thesis that image worship is a sign of degeneration and that it's detrimental to the moral and spiritual well-being of Hindus and progressive society. Both reformers create a discourse in which iconic and aniconic Hinduism came to be seen in stark contrasting terms, irrational and rational, immoral and moral, decadent and progressive, traditional and modern. It juxtaposes their claims with 19th century bhakti-oriented iconic movements such as Swami Narayan and Ramakrishnan, although I have not dealt with them in detail. And these two movements were much concerned with social and religious issues, as with the Arya Samaj and the Brahmo Samaj. In doing so, the paper argues that bhakti or devotion to a personal god represented by a visual image need not be a hindrance to the social, moral, and spiritual transformation of society.
Thank you. Thank you very much indeed. I wasn't familiar with this person. I've never heard of Navala before. Are you happy to take questions and comments, Sharada?
Yes, certainly, yes.
I have two questions. One is pretty brief. To what extent is he sort of still read today in Shaiva communities? Just, yeah. But the other question is how did he view Christianity? I mean, someone like Ram Mohan Roy, at least sort of saw at least some forms of Christianity, Unitarian sort of Christianity, as basically equal to Christianity, whereas Dayananda Saraswati famously kind of was very harsh on Christians and not pretty much everyone who's not teaching what he's teaching in the Satyagraha Prakashan and other works. But Navalar, he was involved in Bible translation,
yeah.
and you mentioned that he's kind of using Hebrew text to kind of say, you know, look, what we're doing is not so strange because you know, it was done there as well. But was that merely a very pragmatic and sort of approach, or was he actually saying what the Old Testament is talking about is somehow similar to what we're doing here, and therefore is equally valid,
we have to situate the discussion in the 19th century context. So therefore, Navalar is a bit polemical there, because that was the point in time when missionaries were stationed in Sri Lanka, and the conversions were going on, and Saivism is a predominant religion there. So when Saiva religion was being criticized right, left, and center by missionaries, I think Navalar perhaps could not help, having studied Hebrew and having helped in the translation of the Bible, and he was in a privileged position, so to speak, knowing English as well as Tamil, to be able to, you know, show back to the missionaries. And Ram Mohan Roy, to a great extent, perhaps he was, Ram Mohan Roy's intention was perhaps more different. His understanding of Christianity, I think Ram Mohan Roy was much more favorable to the message of Jesus. In fact, Roy felt the message of Jesus would be quite helpful to India, the ethical message. He was not interested in the doctrinal baggage of Christianity, like the incarnation, the virgin birth, so forth and so on. And for Navalar, I think he was mainly dealing with the missionary critique of Hinduism, and how contract the. I've not read other bits of Navalar in Tamil. I may have to investigate that a little bit more to see whether there was any dialogical element to it, or it was purely polemical. I think maybe there was a bit of dialogue, perhaps initially, when the Methodist, principal of the college, invited him to teach English, and also because of his fluency in Tamil, he asked him to help in the translation. To that extent, that version is called Navalar's version. The Bible is called Navalar's version. So in that sense, I think I may have to read that closely to comment upon that, to what extent Navalar perhaps was dialogical, which I may have to investigate a little. Maybe initially, yes, perhaps there would have been some element when you're engaged in translation. But in the process, you discover that there are a lot of similarities. Then it could be two purposes. What you said is, on the one hand, polemical. On the other hand, why are you saying this? You have it in your own tradition. It could be both. I need to investigate that a little bit more. I don't know whether I answered your question. Have I?
And to what extent is he still read today?
I think there.
Is he like a figure that's forgotten? Or?
No, he's not forgotten. I think Navalar is remembered in certain, orthodox Shaiva circles, because, if you find the Shaivites in Sri Lanka are they have been influenced by the Navalar tradition. They recite the Thevaram, their scripture, and they go to the temple more often than, say, other Hindus in India would do. For example, my niece, who's a Sri Lankan, they're very particular that she would go to temple on certain days, and they were strict vegetarians, although they might eat meat on certain other days. They are strict vegetarians. So therefore, in one sense, you find that he has stabilized the Shaiva tradition in a way that the Sri Lankans are quite familiar with. Unfortunately, here in England, we have not explored how Sri Lankans practice the tradition, to a great extent, it's a Brahmanical, Sanskritized Hinduism. That is what which we see in diaspora here. To some extent, we see some, the Vaishnavite Bhakti that is also there. The Shaivite Hinduism is not sort of that predominant. But what I can say with my Sri Lankan acquaintances, what I can say is that if not directly, indirectly, the Shaiva tradition, he has laid the foundation of the Shaiva tradition. To this extent, children, Sri Lankan children are taught Tamil, first thing. They all, most Indians, Telugus and others from India, they don't seem to learn the language. But there is Sri Lankan Tamils, they're sent to Tamil schools, which Navala wanted, because if you don't know your language, you're lost.
In the UK?
And as well as generally, you know, even in the Sri Lankan context, of course, you have to know Tamil.
Yeah, listen, I have some friends my age who go to Tamil school on Sundays.
Yeah.
So they do learn Tamil right now as well.
Yeah. So in that sense, one could say that he's laid the foundation. To that extent, he has been very influenced. And there are, and I think he's also being revived in certain Shaivite circles. He's not dead and gone. Like, for example, nobody remembers the Brahmo Samaj in the way that one remembers, say, Dayanand Saraswati. I think Arumugam Navalar is not all that lost. He's being revived. To what extent, I need to do more research.
What was the missionary response to Navala, and did Navala's presence have kind of a negative effect on missionary work in Sri Lanka?
Yeah, in the sense, like, I think missionaries felt a bit handicapped because whatever you say, coming, the missionaries were from the Protestant tradition, you know, at least the missionaries he was dealing with, the principal of the particular college and others were from the Protestant tradition. So when you textually show, and they are silenced, see, basically the Western Protestant tradition, unlike the Catholic tradition, where tradition is very important, if I'm wrong, do correct me, okay? Where tradition is important, text and tradition are important. In the Protestant tradition, to a great extent, they go by the text. So if you're able to demonstrate using your text, then it's extremely difficult to retaliate. So therefore, in one sense, you could say that Navala sort of silenced them by showing very few Indians, for that matter, know Hebrew, Latin, or Sanskrit. So Navala was able to do that, and the 19th century to do that was quite a unique thing. So I think they were a bit silenced. And in fact, it created a revival of Saivism and a kind of an orthodox, purified form of Saivism. And also the caste got solidified. So Sri Lanka, I think the Velalas are very conscious of being Velalas. Like in India, some Brahmins are very conscious of being Brahmins. Okay. Like here, Anglicans are very conscious of being Anglicans. It's just not Brahmins being conscious of being Brahmins. You find in every community, you know, people are being conscious who they are and what they are. So in that sense,
I'm just curious to know if these two strands are continuing today in any sort of debate.
Which
today?
One?
Navalar and then Roy and Diana.
No, I know. I don't know. This is. I don't think anybody has compared Roy and Navala. I know my husband has done some work in this area, in a different context. I don't. Hudson has done. Okay, he's not compared Navala with Roy. I'm not sure. I've read Hudson quite. Whatever he's written, Dennis Hudson, he's quite an expert in Tamil Shaiva tradition, and he has investigated. Navalar to a great extent. So he's one, in terms of comparison, the three of them, I don't think I've come across comparing Roy, Dhaya and Navalar. It just struck me, actually, I wrote this piece initially as only as Roy and Dhaya. I have whole sitting there in my office, and then suddenly, because we had this Navala Tamil, which we ordered, it was sitting there on the table. Suddenly, I just read a little bit of Navala. Then I thought, why can't I use Navala as a counter-narrative to Roy and Dayanand Saraswati? Because here was a good example of how he was using scriptures to affirm ritualistic practices, whereas Roy and Daya were using scripture in order to denounce or to get rid of ritualistic practices. Mm-hmm. For them, it's more acquaintance with the learned and the pious people that's important. So in that sense, they're very Protestant, you know. It's okay, you sit and meditate and then do charity work, and that's... So I don't think, unless somebody else has done... I read a part of this paper at a Bond conference about 3 years ago, I think, okay? Mm-hmm. Then I developed a little bit, and this one... This was read at a Bond conference, I don't know, 3 years ago? I forget. Not the whole of it, but an abridged version of this. And I don't think... Because since I've not published this as yet, I don't know if anybody's...
Well, I look forward to reading this as a book, I imagine. There's a book potential here. So we have to fold up now.
Yeah,
but
okay.
Thank you so much for coming to speak to us. And we'll just give you some thank you.
Thank you.